I'm Bill Shelton. I'm from the Pacific Northwest National Labs in Washington State. I represent the Environmental Molecular Sciences Laboratory, which is a user facility at PNNL. PNNL is one of the DOE national laboratories. I've been there about 18 months. Prior to that, I was 18 years at Oak Ridge National Laboratory, so I have sort of a DOE national lab perspective on things. And so I'm going to give really a perspective at Data at EMSL. Now, I don't know how much you know about the national labs, but they function in a variety of ways. They're broken up into directorates usually, and their funding comes down from DOE like that. Each one has a different mission, but also the national labs are what are called national user facilities, and EMSL is one of those. You may have heard of the Nano Centers. They're a type of user facility. These are facilities that you can gain access to do your research, and it doesn't matter which part of the world you're from. So we have users from Asia, Europe, 42 states in the United States, Australia, and other places. And so they're really designed to try to bring larger groups of scientists together to tackle fairly significant problems. One issue with, let's see, which one do you click here to get it to change the slide? One of the areas? No. Ah, there we go, okay. Is we've had with science in general in the U.S., the culture has always been, data sharing has always been an issue. And one of the things we want to take on, we believe, is that data is being generated lots of places in the world. When you think of doing science and you look at different experiments, you can have a particular sample which gets run on a variety of instruments, of which now you have to bring that data together in order to make interpretations or to predict new things. You can also think about data integration in terms of different types of data, as you would in biology, where you have different types of omics data. At EMSL, we're kind of unique user facility in that we probably have the largest array of different types of instrumentation. And as part of that institute, we actually have computing as part of that, too. So we have a high-performance computing resource. And it's the only user facility that's integrated all those different aspects. And that's another thing about the labs you probably notice is that some have one big user facility, some have lots of user facilities. So like Oak Ridge, there might be 7 different user facilities. Displacer Neutron Source is one user facility. The Center of Nanophase Material Science is another. The National Center for Computational Science is yet another user facility. And to gain access to all that would require multiple proposals, where at EMSL it's one. And so that's kind of what makes it unique. One of the issues they've all had is over time is maintaining their data. A lot of times it's not. You could do a big experiment and ask where that data is, and you might have a hard time trying to find it. And what we're trying to do is to bring all that together, to make that available to people both who have access to the facility as well as those who don't. So we're developing, with Nancy Washington and myself who is here, we're developing a data policy for EMSL for releasing our data to the general public. What we're trying to do as part of that is to develop collaborative tools that would allow larger groups of people to come together, where it's the science that's going to bring them to our facility in order to make that data available to them for doing that. We are also trying to set up a federated system that will allow us to gain access to other facilities that have data in order to bring their data in with that. But, of course, trying to do all this is a rather large endeavor to take on. And so with that, we've tried to work with communities across the world to help us with developing the tools necessary to do that. And one of the things that is unique about EMSL is it is a multidisciplinary science institution in that it has a full range of science that goes on there because of the instrumentation. So we have biological experts, material scientists, and chemists, and we work in all those different areas. We probably have the richest set of proteomics data in the United States exists at EMSL. Along with that, we have a lot of material science and lots of different science. So here's kind of a view. I want to give you an idea of what type of instrumentation we have. We have a quiet wing for doing microscopy. We have a variety of types of microscopes, ranging from standard STM aberration corrected to environmental microscopes that are aberration corrected but can have different gases and be under high pressure and high temperature. One of the things that's interesting about instrumentation, we also have things like atom probe tomography, a variety of NMR instruments. We have nonlinear spectroscopy, so we have summer frequency generation, second harmonic generation type instruments. We have mass spec, and then we have high performance computing. Now, what actually makes these systems unique isn't the instruments, because you can buy these. It's actually the ability we have to make in situ probes for those instruments. And that's what actually makes these unique and be able to do very unique types of experiments. Probably one of the big drivers at DOE right now in the Office of Science side is the Energy Storage Hub initiatives, which will be coming out next year. Some of the experiments have been done in EMSL, and a lot of times in collaboration with other facilities, is looking at in situ probes for lightweight, high energy density batteries. In that case, it was lithium ion, but a lot of the programs we want to be involved in deal more with lithium air, multivalent ions, et cetera, other types of systems. And as I said, we try to integrate these facilities across so that you can do multiple types of experiments, and usually also as part of those is simulation. And so in this particular picture here, they're looking at catalysis for biomass. So this would be looking at iridium nanoparticles on spinel-type structures. The atom probe, an example, would be we also have ion beam implantation. So this is implantation of gold nanoparticles in MgO. And that's just a simple one-dimensional profile looking down the z-axis as you evaporate atoms layer by layer and what the concentrations look like, both external to the gold nanoparticle as well as internal. And, of course, what you see is there are some MgO still within those gold nanopillars that come out of that. With an NMR, we do some interesting bio-inspired type systems, so PS2 type centers. With non-linear spectroscopy, this is a fairly new instrument. It allows us to interrogate interfaces of multi-phase material, so it could be solid, liquid, liquid-liquid type things. And here we have our mass spec system where a lot of the proteomics is done. And again, we have our high-performance computing, which all comes in as part of this, as part of the research we do. And this is all the type of data we want to make available. We also develop tools for the high-performance computing. So this is where the NWChem chemistry software suite is developed. It has a range of capabilities built within it, ranging from doing standard molecular dynamics all the way to high-level quantum chemistry theory, so things like CCSDT, CI-type methods. We also have in there the ability to do crystalline materials, surfaces, and interfaces. There's a plane wave part to this code, which is called NWPW. We constantly are looking for new ways of doing functionality, and so part of our open source policy is we made this code open source about, when was that, Bert, 2010 or 2011 is when this actually went open source?
Yeah, a
little bit over a year. And this way we've started to develop teams of scientists around this code to help with developing new types of functionality for these particular codes. Kind of listed here are different universities who have been involved over time, both within the U.S. as well as outside of the U.S. In order to start to think about how we're going to bring this data together, the biggest critical problem you have is managing the data. And so one of the projects we have in trying to develop this large tool set is bringing together the data in a consistent way. So as part of the facility, we have petabyte storage systems, from which what we're trying to do is instrument all the data in all of our machines. We have probably on the order of about 77 major instruments and a total of 136 instruments total, I believe, we have in the facility, all of which now are going to be pulling data in the near future back onto the storage system. And we want to put it into formats, allow it to make it all searchable across that system. In addition, what we want to do is build on top of that as a set of collaborative tools that will allow researchers, both internal and external, to come together to look at that data as well. And so that's part of the project. And so what I've drawn here is a rough strategy sort of plot. This is a roadmap. These are various releases of the software, where right now we've released the very first version. Right now we're probably downloading all the data from about 15 instruments at this point. We're getting ready to instrument the rest. This is all going to be automated so that the internal researcher does not have to go in and type in things. That's probably, as you know, can be a real drawback because they won't do it, and then it doesn't get stored. One of the big issues, as you probably are aware of, isn't so much the technology. Over the number of years, we'll be able to get this in and get this working. It's really changing the way people think about data and releasing it. And there are real cultural issues we have to overcome to do that. In the U.S., probably one of the biggest, it's the reward system. The reward system based at universities is based on gaining tenure. And that usually means developing your own research path independent of your neighbor next door. And so there's a culture of not rewarding people for working in larger groups and sharing data. And that's one of the probably the biggest hurdles we're going to be tackling is convincing researchers at universities within the U.S. that this is in their interest to do this. That more science will get done, will be more effective, will actually, even from a budgetary standpoint, be more effective in the way we use our resources if we simply begin to work more closely together. And the places you tend to see that beginning to happening, which are the kind of the usual spots, they're the first ones. Not that it happens in a big way, because the national labs also have issues with that, but what you would see is my example of the lithium-ion battery. That was actually a joint project between two different user facilities at two different laboratories, each one bringing together a different aspect of the problem that the other one didn't have. From the PNNL side, we had the ability to develop the in-situ probe, so all the MEMS devices necessary to actually do an actual prototype battery within a microscopy cell, within a TEM cell. And what Sandia had, the Synth Center had, was they actually had the platform in which to put that on into the microscope. And that's the thing we didn't have. And it came together in a very natural way, and it resulted in a nice science paper and some other things that come out of that. And so the labs, in a way, have a culture of doing that because they're based on much larger groups, and the efforts they go after tend to be larger programmatic rather than individual research efforts. But having said that, there's still lots of issues we have to overcome to make this happen. And with that, I just wanted to give you a rough overview of how the labs work, what they do, and the fact that we do generate a large amount of data ranging on the order right now of approaching probably somewhere in the order of tens to hundreds of petabytes of data across about a 6-month time frame or so. One of the big issues we're going to be facing in the near term from the simulation side, we tend to view simulation like an experiment, and with exascale computing coming online in the U.S. over the next 5 years, it's easily imaginable that if you're running on over a million cores that you will generate a petabyte of data. And what we're going to do with that data, how we're going to analyze it, how we're going to distribute it, how we're going to integrate it with other types of capabilities is going to be a major challenge we're going to be facing, and we're going to be seeing that within the next few years. Because in fact, within the next 2 years, we're looking at this summer alone, we'll probably have machines running at the order of about 20 petaflops. Within probably a year and a half, we'll be at 100, which means the data we'll be generating is going to be on the order of a tenth of a petabyte. And a lot of that data is time dependent. And so it's going to bring in new information, new ways of discovering science that the actual person who did those experiments haven't envisioned. And this is the real power in making the data available. As researchers, when we generate data, we do it within our own context. But there are other contexts within that data that we have yet to take advantage of. And with that, I'll stop and take any questions you have.